It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Greg Gutfeld.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Brett Baer, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. Elisa Brady. Where campus protests meet culture wars, a call to all sides in a polarized nation to start standing up to the bullies on their own side.
When you hate for political reasons, you become somebody's product. You become a news product, you become a political product, you become a political activist's product.
I'm Dave Anthony. While the U.S. helps Ukraine battle Russia, there's an economic battle far north in the Arctic, where climate change could make it easier for us and the Russians to get to lucrative natural resources.
China's trying to get in on it, too, because you have what many people believe are vast amounts of natural gas reserves and oil reserves and rare earth minerals.
We talked to Fox's Bill Hemmer about his trip to Alaska.
And I'm Tammy Bruce. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
A demonstration that began last week at Columbia University spreading to other colleges. Tents popping up, apparently in solidarity with the original protesters who vowed to occupy a lawn on campus until Columbia divests from companies with ties to Israel. The school called in police who cleared the space, but tents were back yesterday. At Yale University, dozens of arrests as protesters removed from a makeshift encampment started blocking streets. NYU and several campuses in Boston, also part of the latest wave of pro-Palestinian protests that sometimes go as far as supporting Hamas.
We are Hamas!
That protester near Columbia's New York City campus, where there have also been more chants of from the river to the sea, days after Columbia President Manoush Shafiq told a House hearing,
"We have already issued a statement to our community saying that language is hurtful and we would prefer not to hear it on our campus."
Shafiq, who's facing calls to resign, shifted Columbia to remote learning for yesterday, an attempt to help de-escalate a situation that many Jewish students say isn't really being addressed, with harassment and in some cases violence on campuses. And there's a broader debate about free speech versus hate speech in an America ever more polarized on many issues.
Really what it comes down to is a kind of a climate of fear and anger and sadness. And that's really weird in colleges.
Arthur C. Brooks is a Harvard professor of management practice and the practice of public and nonprofit leadership. He wrote an opinion piece in the Harvard Crimson called "Make Harvard Happy Again," about a culture of fear and contempt and how the solution isn't getting rid of controversy or diminishing disagreement.
Traditionally, colleges have been thought of as pretty happy places where people have some of the best experiences of their lives. But what's happened in American politics and media is the same thing that's happening on campuses, which is that we become, you know, kind of a culture war type of place. And the result of that is that people are less happy than they used to be. And this is one of the reflections of that in the way that people are acting and people are behaving and treating each other.
Yeah, protesters have held up signs accusing Israel of committing mass murder. Some have taken it a step further, though, by openly supporting Hamas, which did commit mass murder on October 7th. When a situation is this polarized, is there any way to get back to whatever normal is, even if it's just on the college campuses where these protests are happening? Because as you said, there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in this.
There is. And the truth is that college campuses have always been places where very contentious positions have been staked out. And ordinarily, and under the best of times in particular, people can do that without freaking out. I mean, it's most people will remember back to really audacious positions taken by their professors or other students, et cetera. And the whole point was exploring different points of view as opposed to trying to cancel different points of view. That's the big problem. The problem is not that people say outrageous things on campuses. The problem is that there is this kind of orthodoxy and this kind of radicalism that says if you say a particular thing, then we have to get rid of you. We have to hurt you. We have to cast you out. We have to cancel you, whatever it happens to be. I'm not not worried about people saying radical things at all. I just want people to be able to say them and not lose their minds, that to be able to have friends who think very radically different things than they do. And right now, we're not very good at that.
Are you worried about this climate stifling debate for the long term on campuses?
I'm worried about that in America, quite frankly. I mean, if I look at both political parties, and good luck to you if you have an outside view. If you're a Republican that doesn't, hold the Trump line, you're not going to be successful. And if you're a Democrat and you're not left wing enough, you're going to struggle, is the bottom line. And that's just not the kind of climate that I want of open debate inside politics. And that's just reflected in all sorts of other places as well. It's very difficult to go on a particular network, left wing, right wing, whatever wing, and have different points of view and have it be a friendly discussion, which is not the way that things should be in America. And then on campuses, it gets even more bitter because there's a lot of really young people, and they're being fomented to think that anybody who disagrees with them is trying to deny their existence, which is abject nonsense, and it makes life misery.
How do we address that? Is it the education system? Do steps need to be taken early on? And how can that be done without being accused of, trying to indoctrinate young students one way or the other?
Yeah, no, what we need to do is to recognize that our country is being run by activists, and that's just no good. People should have different points of view. When you have activists in charge, however, what activists want is power, and what they want is more power than they currently have, and they'll use almost any means to get it. Now, what we find is that the political parties are being run entirely by activists. Activists have shot through American media, which is why people don't trust media. They don't trust media even on their own side, quite frankly, and we all know that's the case. And it's the same problem on college campuses. We all need to stand up to activists. And this is what we need to do on college campuses, to say, like, this is a place of inquiry. This is a marketplace of ideas. This is the fundamental to a free society is the competition of ideas. And if you can't come here without trying to establish a dogmatic orthodoxy, if you're going to come here and try to get rid of somebody else's speech, go home. You're not welcome here. And those are the kinds of things that we need to start enforcing. We need to become anti-activist activists, I guess.
How do you enforce that, though, and still have healthy barriers, I guess you'd say, drawing lines that can allow all of the students to feel safe? Because right now, there is this fear, and then there are a lot of students, Jewish students in particular, who don't feel safe.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually pretty straightforward. Universities have rules about where you can and where you can't actually do protest. You can't do protest anyplace. You can't disrupt a class. You can't block access to a building. You can't block the right of way of other students. All those things are against the rules, and you have to coldly enforce them non-emotionally and say, the minute you do that, we're going to suspend your access to our community. You're no longer going to be a student in good standing. We're going to have security to make sure that people who come on campus who are not members of our community are trespassing and they'll be arrested. Just follow the rules is what it comes down to. And once we do that, when people can't transgress the rules, when they can't push it too far, they won't have the power that they actually seek. And the activists will be disempowered, and the big majority of people that are there to learn and like each other and fall in love and have fun and all the stuff you're supposed to do in college can actually flourish.
How much of this polarization do you think is social media's fault, or are we kind of taking the easy way out by blaming social media for so many things?
Well, social media makes most things worse, of course. I mean, it does a lot of good things as well. You can get positive approach. You can get positive messages out effectively as well. And fun stuff and funny stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also a great accelerator for negative information and fomenting these ideas that the activists are trying to get across. And so the result of it is that, sure, something that would take months to put together is actually happening quicker. I will point out, however, that about every 50 years, you have a climate like this on college campuses. You go back to 1968 to 73 or something like that, and people were taking over entire administration buildings with arms. I mean, they were bringing guns into, blowing up labs, and it was actually much worse, and there was no social media in those days.
You actually wrote a book with Oprah Winfrey, for anyone who doesn't know, called Build the Life You Want, The Art and Science of Getting Happier. If people were happier in general, how much could that help to bridge some of the gaps on polarizing issues?
It's a great question. And the answer is it would do everything. You know, the truth is you can't just fight hatred and sadness and bitterness and contempt with more hatred, anger, sadness and contempt. You fight it by putting something more positive in its place. You give people what they really want. People will take bitterness. People will take revenge. But what they want is they want more happiness. They want more love. And they don't know how. And so the more that we can actually install this, look, Oprah and I wrote this book because we want to better country. You know, there's a lot of ways we don't see the world the same way, but that's one way we sure do, which is that we want to lift people up and bring them together in bonds of happiness and love using ideas.
I guess the big question too is, you know, how do you get people to take that plunge? It's like you would think people want to feel happier, but when they're in the midst right. of feeling a certain way on a certain issue, that can be a tough sell.
Yeah, it can be, except that people want it. And when these things get bad enough, they won't stay there. This is just the way that history works. People are going to start fighting back and they're going to start figuring out a real truth, which is that when they're really unhappy, the reason is because they're being fired up by people so on their own side. Look, when you hate for political reasons, you become somebody's product. You become a news product. You become a political product. You become a political activist's product. You're working for somebody else when you hate. And people aren't going to put up with that forever. I think that Gen Z actually holds the key to this because they're going to have a rebellion. They're going to rebel against the people at their own universities and you know, people who are telling them what they're supposed to think. And they're going to say, no, I refuse to hate people because they disagree with me. They're not trying to deny my existence because they disagree on these ideological issues, even profoundly in ideological issues. On the contrary, I want to talk to them. I really want to hear about it. And that's ordinarily what would happen. I think that's what's going to happen.
You sound optimistic. Are you hopeful about the future of this country, even the, you know, immediate future in the next weeks and months to come? And what would you say to people who aren't so optimistic or even fearful about what's coming next?
Yeah, you use two words that are really important, optimistic and hopeful. Hopeful and optimistic are not the same. So optimism is a prediction. Hope is active, saying there's something we can do. I am incredibly hopeful. There's so much that each one of us can do. And by the way, what we do doesn't start with changing the whole world. It's changing the lives of people directly around us. You can make the world better in the microcosm that is the world around you by treating with love somebody who disagrees with you and listening to somebody who has a different point of view. You've changed the world. You've literally changed the world in that way. That's an ancient Jewish idea that in each person is the whole world. And that's I'm hopeful because you can. We can. I can. You know, and I'm trying to do that with my work. But I'm also pretty optimistic because, you know, looking at history over the last few hundred years, in the United States, and especially the past 100 years in the United States, we always come back from these things. We learn from them. There's overreach. The people who are the bullies, the leaders who are the bullies, they don't keep power very long.
So hope. It comes down to hope and individual actions.
Yep. And the more we do, and the more we do with courage, and the more we do with good humor, and the more that we model it in our lives by loving other people, the sooner it's going to come.
Harvard professor and author Arthur C. Brooks, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.
This is Tammy Bruce with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The Senate could take the first votes today to set up final approval this week of the foreign aid package the House passed over the weekend. Some for Israel and Taiwan, but most of it, 61 of the $95 billion, would go to additional weapons and ammo and other aid for Ukraine to keep battling Russia's invasion. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham supports that, telling Fox News Sunday,
"If you pull the plug on Ukraine because you don't have enough capability, there goes Taiwan."
But GOP Senator Rick Scott wants his party to block the aid, telling Fox our top national security priority should be stopping illegal immigration and drug smuggling from Mexico.
"Look, I want Ukraine to win. I want Russia to lose. But I want a secure southern border."
Ukraine's president says they need this American assistance as fast as possible.
"I have not been to Ukraine to see this for myself, but I know a lot of people who have. And that is, these trenches for these front lines are so well dug in."
Bill Hemmer co-hosts America's Newsroom on the Fox News Channel weekday mornings, 9 to 11 Eastern.
You would almost have to take out Putin and half its military in order to penetrate the lines of defense that the Russians have built in southeastern Ukraine. I think it's going to be very difficult to make this happen. What I see developing, and I'm not the expert on the military standpoint here, what I see developing is that both sides have dug in. And I don't know if the Ukrainians have the ability to push the Russians back.
Yeah.
I think with greater help, they could keep them where they are.
The thing that Speaker Johnson said the other day was they want the White House to tell everyone what the end game here is. That's the question. How long does this go on? And, okay, let's say Ukraine holds the line. How do you diplomatically end it?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Ukraine doesn't want to give up what they've already given up.
Or do you go on for another year and a half fighting for money from countries like the United States? I think the picture you paint is probably quite realistic. I don't know those answers. Speaker Johnson is putting his job on the line here. And then he's going to have to live with the consequences, and we'll see whether or not, you know, a few members of his party are ready to put his head on the chopping block, so to speak, yet again.
Now to a far different battlefront, far north of Ukraine.
The ice-cold Arctic is a strategic hotspot. It's also home to a wealth of resources.
That's Bill Hemmer in his new Fox Nation special, Battle for the Arctic, where climate change and gradual ice melting could make this Earth's final frontier.
I think China definitely considers himself a near Arctic nation, and what that means to them is they reserve the right to operate in this environment. They have icebreakers, they're building more.
But the U.S. and Russia have been there longer in what could become a literally cold economic war.
Yeah, you know, it's a really fascinating trip we made. Went there about a month ago with the U.S. Navy, and we were embedded for about 72 hours, which you think, oh, 72 hours. You can see and learn so much in such a short period of time, especially when you're having an experience that you've never had before in your life. If you were to rotate the globe from the top, you see 8 countries in the world that have territory on or above the Arctic Circle. And it's the United States, it's Canada, it's Greenland, a lot of territory by way of Denmark, it's Norway, it's Finland, it's Sweden, and it's Russia. And what is striking is that the geography for Russia is so prominent north of the Arctic Circle. It is said that Putin gets 80% of his natural gas wealth north of the Arctic Circle.
80%? That's a lot.
Which is significant. And then you've got this geopolitical story between the U.S. and Russia. And now, as of 2018, the U.S., Russia, and China is trying to get in on it, too, because you have what many people believe are vast amounts of natural gas reserves and oil reserves and rare earth minerals beneath the Arctic.
And rare earth minerals these days more valuable than ever, so as we get into.
So the Chinese, they're not one of these 8 countries, right? But the Chinese declared themselves a near Arctic nation. They have no territory on the Arctic Circle. Everyone in the world looked at them and said, "What are you doing?" They struck a relationship up with the Norwegian government, and they built a science lab on an island called Svalbard, which used to be called Spitsbergen, I do believe, and that's well north of the Arctic Circle. And so they're up there with their own scientists trying to see how the Arctic develops, which the Americans are doing as well. How do I wrap all this in? En route to Dead Horse, Alaska, is that you're in an airplane for 7 hours and you're looking out that window and all you see is ice and snow. And then you land in Dead Horse and you fly 200 miles north into the Beaufort Sea, and all it is ice and snow. And then you chopper north and meet up with a U.S. nuclear submarine, and all you see is ice and snow. And they tell you it all melts. And you say, how is that even possible? In the later months of summer, August, maybe for like a two-week window in September.
Okay.
The White House believes by the year 2030 that we could go from an white Arctic, ice and snow, to a blue Arctic, open ocean. I'm not here to argue that this is the Mediterranean Sea, because it never will be.
Right.
Because quickly thereafter, the cold weather is going to come back and it's going to freeze over again. But they believe you could have a trans-Arctic route where you could ship a lot of material and save many, many days, if not weeks, as opposed to going through the Suez Canal and through the Panama Canal. So that those are just some of the dynamics
and
that you see up there.
China knows that too. And they're preparing for that too. And so does Russia.
And Russia does. And what the U.S. Navy wants Putin to know is that we're there too. And you cannot prohibit any sort of international maritime traffic. And their concern is that Russia is going to charge you a fee or even stop you.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't happened yet, but that's what they're worried about.
With the change and with what may happen, you say, by 2030, the U.S. military has to train for that. If conditions change, they have to be ready for that, too.
Mm-hmm.
When you were dealing with, you got to go on the USS Hampton, right?
Yes.
That's a nuclear submarine.
Amazing.
What was it like? What's the training up there like?
Yeah, the training is intense. It came from San Diego. It was made in Groton, Connecticut. It's 31 years old. It weighs 7,000 tons. They're looking for 3 feet thickness in ice so they can blast up into the ice, but no less than 2 feet, Dave, because they have to be able to brace this structure in the ice so they can cut through the hatch, cut through the ice that leads to the hatch with chainsaws so guys can get on and guys can get off.
All right, so it surfaces to the ice and then they have to cut to get to the surface.
We cut from the outside.
Okay, so it surfaces, then crews have to cut down to it.
Yes. Now, we were...
How long did that take?
It took at least... We were sitting on the ice for 4 hours. You know the thing about the Arctic, because it's all flat. When the wind blows, there's nowhere to hide. And when the wind blows, man, it goes from 20 below quickly to 40 below and 50 below. And they're just like, come on, man, let's get this thing going. You know, you talk about these guys in the submarines, 150 men on the USS Hampton. It's really a fascinating thing. You get on board and the admiral tells you, Bill, we're going to teach you about a commodity of space. I said, well, what's that, sir? I
said, well, in other words, there's no space.
He says, you live your life this big, you find out it's going to be this big, and then it goes to this, and you finally accept the fact that you could just need this much to live. Everything on board that submarine has a purpose. Every hook, every drawer, everything you see, every bed underneath the torpedo room that has a bunk, that has the clearance of 18 inches, all of it has a purpose. They can stay at sea so long as they are operable and don't have any equipment issues. As long as they have enough food, they never have to come home because it's all nuclear powered. It is one of the hottest showers I've ever had, right?
Oh, really?
I mean, because there's nothing but energy on board because of the nuclear-powered sub. They have the best food in the entire U.S. military. And they did that more than 100 years ago because of the issues of morale on board a sub. You're at sea for 3 months. It's pretty hard.
Yeah.
When you go below water, there is no ability for you to transmit. These guys aren't on they're not taking selfies.
No, they weren't watching YouTube.
They're not scrolling
Instagram. You're not on Instagram, no.
No. They read books, they sleep, they have casual conversations, and they work. And everyone has a job all the time. It was very, very impressive.
What did it feel like when you had to, how far down did you go?
350 feet for about 25 hours, I would say.
Did I feel different?
I wasn't quite sure. You know, once you go under and you're watching that monitor and the ice starts to disappear and eventually it goes black because the aft comes down first and then the fore comes down. You're about, it's not 90 degrees, but it may be 70 for a bit. Very smooth. And then you get underway and you can just, it's a nice, easy cruise with a nice hum in the background.
Your experience just being there, I mean, that's the coldest you've ever been, right? I mean,
we're at the ice camp, right? That's where 62 sailors and scientists are set up for about 5 weeks, okay?
5 weeks?
They do it every 2 years. They have a command center in HQ. They have a mess hall that doubles as a meeting space. They have a science lab that studies a lot of the changes that I mentioned earlier. Then they have 9 of these yellow tents, and they're called the Arctic Tent. Literally, Dave, it says the Arctic Tent. 8 are used for sleeping. 1 is the latrine.
Mm.
They have a policy. Whatever you bring in, you bring out.
That's got to be cold going.
Whatever you bring in, you got to bring out.
Uh-huh.
So
the seat's cold there.
Oh, yeah. We slept in a cot with everything on, including our boots, inside of 2 sleeping bags pulled over our heads. I slept for 4 hours. I woke up every hour on the hour.
You wish you were on the sub.
Freezing.
Yeah.
Yes.
The sub was a lot
better. For that submarine.
So that part of the world, most Americans don't go there. And if they do, they're, you know, maybe an Alaskan cruise or something to that effect. But we may not think about it, but that really could be a very, very vital part of the world in the next 20, 30 years.
Oh, I think you're right about that. If the projections about the ice melt are even half true, I think you're very right about that. I will say, though, that, you know, a good 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months, it's going to remain the forbidden place that it is. I'm not joking. When you look out that window and you look down at, you can't tell where the Arctic Ocean ends and where the land begins. And you look down and think, turn this thing around, because there's nothing down there. Very few people, you're right, have had the opportunity to see that part of the world. I am grateful that I did. It has opened my mind to a range of possibilities that, frankly, I had never considered before. I'm glad I did it. I am not anxious to do it again.
You can watch it all on Fox Nation, Battle for the Arctic with Bill Hemmer, who, of course, you can watch weekdays 9 to 11 a.m. with the America's Newsroom with Dana Perino. Bill, great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
You got it. Thanks for taking an interest in the story. I appreciate it, because it was a marvelous experience.
I bet it was. Yeah. Thank you.
You bet.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcast.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tammy Bruce.
What's on your mind?
Biased left-wing journalists keep telling us that they are neither biased nor leftists. But new examples keep popping up that disprove their self-righteous claims and expose their sneering contempt for average Americans. Progressive journalists, who now dominate their profession like never before, want us to think that they follow the old motto of Superman, alias newspaper reporter Clark Kent, and the fight for truth, justice, and the American way. In reality, most are leftist propagandists slanting the news to spread their radical worldview. The latest indisputable evidence of the leftist stranglehold on the mainstream media came when NPR senior business editor Uri Berliner resigned after drawing condemnation from NPR leadership. Berliner's cardinal sin was writing a blistering tell-all essay for the Free Press website, exposing how the public radio network has changed over the course of his 25 years working there, from a news organization into a leftist propaganda organ. After that, NPR hit Berliner with a 5-day suspension without pay, a written rebuke, and a warning that he would be fired if he writes for an outside news organization again without first getting NPR's permission. So much for freedom of the press and allowing the public to consider all things. Apparently deciding he'd had enough, Berliner has, in fact, resigned in an email to NPR CEO Catherine Marr, writing, "I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cite in my Free Press essay." Divisive views indeed. Another example of just how out of touch the leftist media are came from Katie Couric, longtime host of the Today Show on NBC and the CBS Evening News, when she expressed smug and rather patronizing views for ordinary people in a remarkable, candid podcast interview. Looking down on supporters of Donald Trump, multimillionaire Couric described some of them as being motivated by socioeconomic disparities and, quote, a lot of class resentment and anti-intellectualism, end quote. Katie using a word salad to call Americans essentially dumb, poor, and jealous is not going to age well. Poor Katie. Sounds like she was echoing the views of Hillary Clinton in 2016. As the Democratic presidential nominee running unsuccessfully against Trump, Clinton said, "You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. And he has lifted them up." As we might expect, the comments of Clinton and Couric reflect the views of many mainstream journalists. An online survey of 1,600 U.S. journalists in 2022 found that 36.4% said they were Democrats, more than 10 times greater than the 3.4% who said they were Republicans. The majority of journalists said they were not supporters of either major party, reflecting the reluctance of most in media to reveal who they vote for. But it's safe to bet that the lion's share of journalists lean left. Just look at the overwhelming hostility most express in their news coverage of Trump. Too many in the liberal media share the view that anyone with contrary views is somehow evil or just plain dumb. I'm glad Berliner called this out at NPR and sorry he lost his job as a result. More journalists need to look in the mirror, see their leftist bias for what it is, and put dedication to truth-telling ahead of their role as progressive propagandists. I'm Tammy Bruce. This column originally appeared at amac.us, that's amac.us. I'm a Fox News contributor. And on July 23rd, I have a new book coming out called Fear Itself. It looks at the use of fear to control society. You can pre-order that right now wherever you buy your books.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now.
Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.